Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for August 19, 2004. This is Doug Henwin. We're looking to do most weeks at this time at the world of economics and politics. We've got two guests up for tonight. First, we'll speak with Heather Boucher, who is an economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, about a couple of things. One, the government is releasing its official income and poverty numbers a week from today, and we're going to take an advanced look at that. But also, she's been looking at some other numbers, trying to figure out what's going on with the material welfare of the American population. Looks like we're seeing an increase in poverty, but also some increase at the, in incomes at the high end, that is, growing inequality. Which is a very old story in this country. It's started around, 1967, sometime between 1967 and 1972, depending upon how you measure it. But we've been growing more unequal now for the last 35 years. And we'll talk with Heather about that. And then just after 5:30, we'll speak with Dennis Lloyd-Johnson, who is a publisher of Melville House Books and an author also of a book just published by Melville House called The Big Chill, The Great Unreported Story of the Bush Inauguration Protest, which is part of a series of three little and very cute little books. The other, Mark Danner's The Road to Illegitimacy, One Reporter's Travels Through the 2000 Florida Vote Recount, and then also in that series, Renata Adler's Irreparable Harm, the U.S. Supreme Court, and the decision that made George W. Bush president. So three topical, short, and attractive-looking books, and we'll speak with the author of one of them and the publisher of the three, Dennis Lloyd-Johnson, in about half an hour. First, some looks at the economic headlines. I've been mentioning frequently the Index of Leading Economic Indicators, a weekly Index of Leading Economic Indicators compiled by the Economic Cycles Research Institute, whose principal compiler, Lakshman Achuthan, was on this show a couple of months ago. That index, which, as I said, comes out weekly, is meant to forecast the twists and turns of the U.S. economy about 6 months down the road. It's been weakening now for quite several months now and suggesting that the second half of 2004 will be considerably slower, economically speaking, than the first half of 2004. Well, the granddaddy of these leading indicators, the one compiled by the Conference Board, which is a monthly thing, the July edition of that was just released this morning, and it was off by 0.3%, the second consecutive monthly decline, and the first time this has happened in about a year and a half. It's way off its peaks of about 6 months ago, March of this year. So this too, telling a very similar story. No recession as of yet, but certainly a considerable economic slowdown in the cards for the rest of this year going into next year. And compounding that is the fact that usually the first year of a presidential term is the weakest of the four presidential years. The old election cycle also suggesting that the economy is slowing down. How this will affect people's perceptions, whether it will enter their perceptions, is another story. But it does seem like the stimulus of tax cuts, the stimulus of heavy borrowing against depreciated home values, and the stimulus of extended very low interest rates by the Federal Reserve, all these things now evaporating. In the case of the Federal Reserve, they're raising interest rates, so that stimulus is turning into a contractionary impulse. But the stimuli have run their course, and it still remains quite remarkable that despite the massive stimulus coming from giant budget deficits, big tax cuts, big defense spending increases, that plus very low interest rates in the Fed, and we have not been able to generate a very strong economic recovery, suggests that there's still some serious underlying problems with the U.S. economy that have not worked themselves through yet. It may be that the recession of 2001-2002, the very weak recovery of 2002-2003 into 2004, the downdraft that came after the bursting of the stock market bubble has yet to go through its final act. So we shall see in the coming months, but it looks like things are slowing down. Also this morning, was reported the tally of initial jobless claims, that is, people who have lost their jobs and head over to the unemployment insurance for register for benefits, a very timely and sensitive indicator of what's happening with the job market. That indicator fell by 3,000 last week to 331,000. But although it's been trending down the last couple of weeks, it's been basically flat now for the last several months. So it certainly has shown considerable improvement since the weaker job market of last year, but it is not suggesting any kind of acceleration. And the report of 32,000 jobs gained in July, I think, was probably a bit too low. But we're not also putting on the kind of 300,000 jobs you'd expect in a vigorous and normal recovery. So the headline numbers, GDP and such, are reasonably strong, although not gigantically strong, as some people would have you believe. But that's really not filtering down into the labor market. It's improving, but got a long way to go. Also, the ABC magazine, ABC News and Money Magazine weekly poll of consumer attitudes declined for the second consecutive week. So it experienced a considerable rise between June and the beginning of August, and now is eroding again. So it seems that people are perhaps reacting to the poor job numbers for July, or just feeling that the job market's not treating them very well. The stock market's been kind of wobbly, although Google performed kind of well today. But that is also eroding, so we shall see if people slow down their spending as a result. The Federal Reserve reported a couple of days ago that industrial production for July gained 0.4% of 1%, but that did not compensate for the loss of 0.5% in June. So also industrial production... Well, it improved from June's reading, is still on the weakish side, and certainly also not in any kind of acceleration or uptrend. And the Consumer Price Index was reported earlier this week to have declined by 0.1% in July, mainly pulled down by lower gasoline prices. Gasoline prices fell a bit in July, but they should be rising again as crude oil sets record levels, $47 and change now. Up from about $30 a year and a half ago. So those high oil prices are one of the things that are weighing down in the economy. Not the only thing by any means, but it's one of the things. And that moderation in the consumer price index may not last if oil prices remain high. And let's see, turning abroad, the ZEW indicator of sentiment in the German economy declined in the month of August, and it's well below 50 now. So it's also suggesting a moderate expansion, but a little weaker outlook for the German economy. And the Japanese economy seems to be slowing a bit. The OECD's leading indicators for all the major economies weakening. Again, not to recession levels, but slowing down. So we're hardly experiencing a delightful economic boom pretty much anywhere in the world. One exception, Mexico, which has just reported a 3.9% growth rate for the second quarter of this year, up from the previous quarter, and actually up from the highest in many quarters. So things doing well in Mexico, mainly because of demand coming from the United States. Now, again, in Mexico, while the headline numbers are looking better, the job market has not been following suit. As someone once said, I think it was a president of Brazil, the economy is doing well, but the people aren't. And you can say that about a lot of places these days. Let's take this little musical break, a little backward glance to the avant-garde of the late 1960s, Karlheinz Stockhausen's Stimmung, and then we'll be back with Heather Boucher. ¶¶ And that little musical break was from Karlheinz Stockhausen's Stimmung from 1969, a glance back to the days of the high avant-garde. And now we're joined by Heather Boucher, who is an economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Welcome to WBII, Heather.
Thank you, Doug. It's a pleasure to be on the show today.
So, always good to have you. So, I guess we can play the game with the income and poverty numbers that Wall Street plays with all the other economic statistics. What are you looking for when the Census Bureau reports a week from today?
Well, when the Census Bureau releases its new data on income, poverty, and health insurance a week from today, I think that we will see that the economy did not perform as well as we might have wanted or as hoped in 2003 for America's families. Preliminary analysis that we've conducted for the first half of 2003 shows that it looks like poverty went up in the first half of 2003 compared to the first half of 2002, and health insurance coverage dropped considerably, especially among children and especially among children receiving employer-provided health insurance. So a lot of kids have been dropped from their parents' employer-provided plans over the first half of 2003. So given that the labor market didn't, although the labor market picked up a bit in the second half of 2003, inflation-adjusted average weekly earnings did not. So putting all that together, I think that the numbers aren't going to look very good.
And if we can extrapolate that to the present, while we're seeing higher employment numbers, the real wage numbers have been falling even more than last year.
Exactly. And, you know, wages and salaries make up 75% of total family income in the United States, and they make up almost all of total family income for families in the bottom 80 or 90% of the labor market. So, you know, as the labor market goes, so does family income and economic well-being. So even though employment has picked up a bit, we haven't seen strong sustained employment growth, and inflation-adjusted wages are now falling. So take-home income can't be doing all that well right now.
And you mentioned health insurance. There's a story on the front page of the Times today that employers have been holding back in hiring people because of the rising cost of health insurance, which has been shooting upwards, even though, you know, we're supposedly in a relatively not non-inflationary time. And then, of course, people who are not lucky enough to have health insurance are finding the bite even worse. So, what exactly did you find with the health insurance coverage?
Well, we looked specifically at whether or not folks had health insurance coverage in the first half of 2003, and whether or not they were getting it from an employer or whether or not they were getting it from the Medicaid system. We're looking only at folks under the age of 65, sort of taking out of the equation folks who are on Medicare. And what we found is that coverage has dropped, and it has dropped fairly considerably. Looking between the first half of 2002 compared to the first half of 2003, 71.9% of Americans were on an employer-provided health plan during at least 1 month between January and June of 2002, while only 70.5% were in 2003, a 1.4 percentage point decline. Given how slow
that's pretty hefty in the space of a year, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Given how slow these kinds of numbers move, that is a rather significant decline. And we know that a lot of it is related to higher unemployment. So if people don't have jobs, they don't get employer-provided health insurance, and declining dependent coverage. These are sort of long-standing trends. The idea that employers are saying, oh, well, we can't hire somebody because we have to give them health insurance may or may not be the case. I'm less convinced that that's why a lot of employers aren't hiring, because a lot of the kinds of jobs where we're seeing employment growth are in sectors where people don't typically offer health insurance. So, you know, people could, you know, sort of change their whether or not they offer health insurance at all. So I don't know how big of a detriment that is.
Now, I don't get too deep into the geekery of this, but the income and poverty numbers that the Census Bureau will be releasing a week from today come from something called the Current Population Survey. But what you've been looking at is something called the Survey of Income and Program Participation, or SIP. Tell us a little about SIP and what kind of numbers those are.
Well, thank you for asking. I love talking about the data. You know, the SIP is a series of what are called longitudinal panels. That is, they ask the same set of people questions over time. So the same set of households are being interviewed every 4 months over a period of 3 to 4 years. So it gives us a much richer picture of what's going on in terms of people cycling on and off public programs, moving in and out of health insurance coverage, or how people's individuals' wages change over time, which is very different than the March Current Population Survey, which is the data that will be released next week, which just surveys a different set of people each March about their experiences in the previous year. So they're able to get a cross-section, just a snapshot of how families are doing, whereas in the SIP, we're really able to look at how individual families are faring over time. Particularly when you're looking at health insurance coverage, I think using data where the questions are asked more frequently really gives us a much richer picture. One of the things that we saw for 2002 is that 91% of Americans had some health insurance over 2002 for any month. But when you ask, when you use the SIP to say, okay, well, how many of those people had health insurance every single month, you find that only 72% of Americans had health insurance every single month. So there's a gap of 20 percentage points, which is quite significant in terms of the number of people who were on health insurance in 2002 for at least part year. We don't have the full data for 2003 yet, but that gap, I'm sure, will continue.
And we're talking about, 50, 60 million people, so these are big numbers.
These are very large numbers. And, you know, we all know that, you know, whether or not you have health insurance has nothing to do with whether or not you're sick or if you need to go to the doctor or whether or not you have a pre-existing condition. So the fact that so many Americans are cycling on and off during the course of a year is a significant policy problem, and the SIP allows us to look at that in ways that the March Current Population Survey just can't let us see.
I'm speaking with Heather Boucher, who's an economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research based in Washington, D.C. And what else when we talked this morning, you said you found rising incomes and also rising poverty rates. What does that mean?
That is a very interesting little conundrum. For the first half of 2003, we saw that in inflation-adjusted terms, median household income has risen by a little bit over $500. Now, you know, a rise of $500, given how large median household income is relatively insignificant. You know, median household income is about $48,000 a year. So that's not a very large increase, but it is an increase nonetheless. That combined with
that is pretty crummy for what's supposed to be an economic recovery, though.
That is entirely crummy for an economic recovery, yes. And when you combine that with rising poverty, what that indicates to me is that we might be seeing that might be an indication of rising income inequality, because the poverty line measures how many people are falling below a certain threshold. So we're seeing more people with low incomes, yet the average income is rising, which is undoubtedly because folks at the top are pulling it up. One thing that I'd like to sort of note about that is that these numbers do not take into account the tax cuts. So if we were to look at income changes post-tax cuts, I think we'd see an even more dramatic inequality story, given the way that the tax cuts were implemented over the past few years.
Now, you and I imagine most of our listeners, care deeply about inequality, but it just doesn't seem to take off as a political issue. Do you have any sense of why that is?
Well, I don't think it has taken off as a political issue, but it has been one of the cornerstones of what John Edwards was talking about on the campaign trail, and part of what sort of made its way into the Kerry platform, is he's been talking about the notion of two Americas. So I think income inequality, in terms of just looking at the numbers, like, you know, how much low-income families earn versus high-income families. I think that there isn't enough texture to that for people to really hold on to. But when we talk about mobility and whether or not families have the opportunity to move into the middle class and whether or not there are different kinds of, whether or not rich people and poor people have access to different kinds of schools and health care and services, I think that does touch the public imagination. So talking about it in terms of what that means concretely seems to be a lot more interesting than just talking about the data.
Now, I don't know how this exactly works out, but this pattern of falling real wages, rising poverty rates, even in what looks like an economic recovery / expansion, is you know, characterizing the Bush years, but also characterized the Reagan-Bush 1 years. Is this some kind of Republican model of how an economy works?
Well, it does appear to be if you look at past practice. You know, it's very unfortunate because this does mean the millions of families are losing out and are unable to have their standard of living keep pace with the rate of inflation. But I do think that this is the outgrowth of specific kinds of policies. You know, you implement tax cuts that primarily benefit wealthy families, and they have even more money to invest, and wealth begets more wealth, and you have low-income families who really didn't benefit very much from these tax cuts, and I think that just kind of keeps them churning there at the bottom. They still don't have enough money to send their kids to college so that they can move on up the ladder or get health insurance so that they're well enough to go to work. And I think you see a whole host of policies in terms of regulation and how we think about labor markets that have happened over the past few years that disadvantage low-income families. In particular, we haven't raised the minimum wage since 1996. We're, at 8 years since the last minimum wage increase. And we haven't seen this Republican administration really focused on the fact that we do have so many millions of American families without health insurance, and they are disproportionately at the bottom end of the income spectrum.
Well, they've got medical savings accounts.
Yes, but most of those families do not. The medical savings accounts primarily go to families who, quite frankly, don't really need it because they already have health insurance and they're using those savings accounts to help pay for their co-payments and other sorts of things, which is fine, but certainly is not doing much at all to expand coverage or to get coverage to folks right now who don't currently have it.
And this has been controversial, but there's been people who look at the current job numbers. They're at a pretty high level of abstraction, so it's kind of hard to get a really fine-grained picture of what's going on. But it looks like the kinds of jobs we've been generating over the last year or so have been kind of low-wage, low-skill jobs, and some gains at the very top, but lots of retail jobs and that sort of thing. So that would sort of comport with the picture you've been painting of people at the top doing quite well, but also this kind of two economies story, this bifurcating, bifurcating economy. Is that the way it looks to you?
That is the way it looks to me. We also saw, I believe it was 40 months, or correct me if I'm wrong, it was some number around 40 months of sustained job losses in manufacturing.
43 consecutive months.
Thank you. 43 consecutive months.
Without precedent since the monthly numbers began in 1939. There was never a string like that, even in the Rust Belt era, the early 80s.
It's absolutely astounding. And those were the kinds of jobs that were middle-class jobs, many of them were at the low end as well, but many of those jobs were providing solid middle-class wages to their workers. And so it's not just the kinds of jobs that are being created, and they are disproportionate, I think, being created at the bottom end, but it's the kinds of jobs that are being destroyed. So we're seeing the destruction of these jobs, and we're also seeing a lot of displacement of older workers who are typically at the peak of their earnings capacity, and when they're displaced, most of them are not able to find jobs that provide the same level of income or may not be able to find jobs with health insurance. And so I think you're seeing that as well. So a kind of moving down instead of moving up the economic ladder, folks kind of moving down the economic ladder as this recovery has moved forward.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, but what kind of policies would you think would be appropriate to reverse these unhappy trends?
Well, I think first and foremost, we need to focus on policies that will create solid job growth. And I think that we need to look to rescinding significant portions of these tax cuts that went to the wealthiest American families and use some of those resources in other ways to actually create sustained job growth. This policy by all accounts right now, has certainly not created sustained job growth, and we'd like to, you know, see that change. And then second, I think that really focusing on policy changes to the way that we provide health insurance and making sure that de-linking health insurance and employment, so that just because you're unemployed shouldn't necessarily mean that your family should go without health insurance coverage, I think is the second most important area that we need to be looking at to help kind of level the playing field for both families and employers. If we can de-link competitive, you know, a firm's competitive pressures from whether or not they provide health insurance, I think we'd go a long way to helping good firms compete.
Now, when you talk to your friends and neighbors in Washington and you go to meetings and talk to colleagues, is there much agreement into that, or are people still lost in the neoliberal era?
Well, that all depends on which parties I'm going to. I think that there is consensus that we need to be doing something about job creation. I think folks are fairly clear on that. And I think there's also clear consensus that we need to do something about health insurance and something about cost containment in terms of health care costs. I think the answers are still not clear to people, but I do think that more people now are at least being open-minded to the idea of a Medicare for All program or something that would extend health insurance to the folks that don't have it, and rethinking whether or not an employer-based system is the way to go. The cover article that you mentioned from the New York Times today is a perfect example of something that's really questioning whether or not the best way to provide health care is through employers. Because then you're conflating all of these different issues. Employment growth shouldn't be about whether or not people have access to health care. It should be about whether or not the firm needs another worker. So I do think that that people are starting to really question the viability of this model.
Of course, when you say something about any kind of public health insurance initiative, people, but taxes, we have to raise taxes. What's your answer to that cry of distress?
Well, my answer to that is that, you know, this is something that we are paying for anyway. Americans pay more for health care than people in any other developed country. And quite frankly, we have worse health outcomes. We don't live as long. We have higher maternal mortality rates. We have higher infant mortality rates. And we're paying for it. We're paying for it with high insurance premiums, high health care costs, and tax dollars that are going to both Medicaid and Medicare. So it's not that these costs somehow disappear if we say that the government isn't going to pay for them. What we should be focused on is coming up with the most efficient way to provide these services, the most cost-effective way, and then figure out how we're going to pay for it in, again, the most efficient and cost-effective way. It doesn't really matter to me if you take a health insurance premium out of my paycheck, if my employer takes it out of my paycheck, or if the government takes it out of my paycheck. What I want is for the system to be efficient and fair and to provide good health care access. So we're paying for it anyway, and I think people need to rethink that. It's the same with Social Security. We're paying for all of this anyway. It's just how we distribute the costs.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us, Heather Boucher. A lot of people don't like to talk about how we distribute the costs.
I know.
It's just not a popular topic in some circles.
Well, we're about changing that, right?
Yes, we are. All right. Heather is an economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research based in Washington, D.C., and they have a website at cepr.net. And I'll be back in a minute after this break. And we're back on Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood. And now in the second half of the show, a couple of items that I didn't get a chance to talk about at the top of the show. Get to this before we bring on Dennis Johnson. First of all, the Chinese province of Shaanxi performed an interesting exercise, which not too many jurisdictions in the world have done. They calculated so-called green GDP, that is, it accounts for economic production less environmental costs being the depletion of natural resources as well as damage caused by pollution. And it discovered that first of all, if you subtract those bad things from GDP, that takes off about a third of the total amount. That even though the headline official numbers for GDP growth in 2002 were close to 12%, the costs incurred through pollution and through resource depletion erased almost all of that gain. The province of Shaanxi barely grew after you subtract those environmental costs. So it almost 12% before adjusting for environmental degradation, and close to zero once you do adjust for environmental degradation. And it's not true of 2002, but pretty much the entire of the last 20 years. So even though China has been clocking enormous growth numbers over the last couple of decades, if the experience of Shaanxi, a province of coal mining heartland southwest of Beijing, Shaanxi province, if the rest of the country had experience broadly similar to that province, then a lot of those gains are just illusory, because the environmental degradation and resource depletion has been subtracting from what looks like great headline growth numbers. And second, I just thought I'd read this little piece that I wrote the other day that may not actually see the light of day at publication, so I thought I'd share it with the listeners here. From the first, I've been ambivalent about Mayor Bloomberg's crusade against tobacco. While I welcome the improvement in the air quality inside bars and am happy to return home from a night of carousing without smelling like an ashtray, the smoking ban is also part of the general war on fun that has afflicted New York City ever since Rudy first took office. As literary theorist Richard Klein argued in his wonderful book Cigarettes Are Sublime, anti-smoking campaigns, for which anti-tabagism is the term of art, are usually part of a broader social crackdown whose aim is to increase state power at the expense of individual freedom. In other words, the no-smoking sign and the Patriot Act are of a piece. But I've just hit upon a way to stop worrying and love the smoking ban. It's a form of fiscal revenge on Washington. Lest that seem too far-fetched, here's the reasoning. We all know that New York City gets a raw deal from the feds. Every year we send buckets of taxes to D.C. and get very little in return. The latest outrage was learning late last year that Wyoming is getting bigger anti-terror subsidies per capita than New York State, $38 per person versus $5 per person, even though it's a lot easier to imagine a dirty bomb hitting Times Square than downtown Casper. But that's only the latest in a long line of insults. Residents of the South and West can rail all they like against those evil bureaucrats in Washington, but the federal government has been for decades subsidizing their schools, highways, and irrigation projects, while we have to cope with the West Side Highway. According to a Tax Foundation study, New York gets back 85 cents worth of spending for every dollar it pays in taxes, federal taxes. All of the southern states and most of the western ones get back more than a dollar, many of them a lot more. So let's think about smoking in this context. Smokers are far more likely to suffer from serious diseases than non-smokers, and they're more likely to die young as well. As cold hard as it may look to do the fiscal math, that means that tobacco raises public spending on health care while lowering spending on Social Security, because people don't live long enough to collect their pensions. Public health care spending means mainly Medicare for the elderly and Medicaid for the poor. While Social Security and Medicare are entirely federal programs, Medicaid is partly funded by the states. New York State is unusual in that it requires localities to pick up a substantial portion of these costs. The sums involved aren't small. About one in every $10 New York City spends goes to Medicaid. And it's been estimated that smoking is responsible for 8% of total Medicaid expenditures. Cutting smoking would save the city scores, maybe hundreds of millions of Medicaid dollars. Of course, it would save Albany and Washington money as well. But if all those ex-smokers lived longer, then the federal government would have to write a lot more Social Security checks. We gain, Washington loses. Anti-tabagism can pay dividends. And we'll be back with Dennis Johnson after this word from Karl-Heinz Stockhausen.
Saturday. 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 Satur
And we're back. That was a little bit from Karlheinz Stockhausen's 1969 composition Stimmung. Somehow I pulled it off the shelf the other night because I hadn't listened to it in a long, long time and read the liner notes. And there was a performance in Amsterdam in 1969, which, as Stockhausen reports, started initially going very well. And then a bunch of revolutionaries in the audience denounced the hierarchicalism, authoritarianism of having performers on stage and while the audience couldn't participate. And so it sort of descended into a riot. But that seems like what happened, the end of the 60s avant-garde, as the hippie culture collided with avant-garde high culture and all split apart. So last 35 years, it looks like the high culture took a dive, and the anti-authoritarian culture, at least in its less commercial versions, was on the rise. So we're now back with Dennis Lloyd-Johnson, who joins us in this studio. He's the author of a book called The Big Chill, The Great Unreported Story of the Bush Inauguration Protest, and it's part of a series of three books published by Melville House Books, also Mark Danner's The Road to Illegitimacy and Renata Adler's Irreparable Harm, the Danner book about the Florida recount and the Adler book about the Supreme Court decision that made Bush president. Welcome to you, WBAI, Dennis Johnson.
Doug, it's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you're, aside from being an author, are you the publisher at Melville House Books?
I am one of the publishers at Melville House, that's true.
So tell us about, before we talk about the book, tell us about Melville House. We had one of your authors on here a while back, Bernard-Henri Lévy, talking about his search for Danny Pearl's murders.
That's right. Well, that book is one of our early claims to fame, a young company, but... But we've actually done a couple of books now with Bernard, and it's thrilling. Those are, I think, two of the most important books of the last several years. He was in his search for what happened to Daniel Pearl. He was way ahead of the curve on questions about Pakistani intelligence involvement and did they have nuclear weaponry and so on like that. He had it way before the U.S. government was fessing up to similar concerns a year later. So we've gotten off to a good start. And now we're really pleased about these books, really very excited to be working with authors like Mark Danner and Renata Adler.
And I've got to say they're very attractive little books as well, as, aside from their content.
Thank you. That's one of the important goals, I think. We're trying to remind people of the lovely artifact of the book itself.
Yeah, it's nice in these days of instant electronic communication that the printed product also has its great charms.
That's right. Something the big book publishers have been overlooking, I think.
So let's talk about your book first, The Big Chill, you're writing about the protests against the Bush inauguration. I have to admit, I didn't go down myself because the weather was so lousy. My wife went down and reported to me on it, but I was a climatic coward and stayed home.
Well, obviously that's where I got the title of the book, part of it anyway. But it was terrible, and I think that just speaks all the more strongly to how powerfully people felt they needed to speak up, because it was utterly miserable, and they delayed things, trying to make us all the more miserable as we waited and hoping more of us would disperse and go away. That's the tactic now against dissent. You wait it out. You hope that it breaks up and goes away.
So what brought you down to Washington for January 20th, 2001?
Well, we forget now with 9/11 between now and then, but that was a really traumatic election. And there were some of us in this country that felt that the democratic process had indeed broken down. And I think it's important to observe that a big part of those protests were not necessarily directed at the man, the character, the person of George Bush, but at a statement about what was going on in this democracy. People felt he hadn't been elected, and that was why many, many were there.
And so... There were very fairly populous and very vigorous protests despite the bad weather. Tell us what you saw.
Well, what I saw was protesters everywhere, and It was the first time I've been to a few protests in my life, not a lot, but several significant ones. And this was the first one I had been to that just felt so very controlled by the police. The authorities were ready for a significant crowd. They had some very sophisticated tactics ready to control that crowd, to split it up, to make people go away. And it was a very oppressive event, a very oppressive day there in Washington between the cops and the army and the weather.
You write about an attempted march of the Supreme Court. What happened with that?
Well, it was broken up, again, to emphasize that people were upset about the process as much as the person. A lot of people thought that the thing to do that day was to go and protest at the Supreme Court because, of course, the feeling was that Bush had been appointed and not elected. And most people were prevented from getting anywhere near the Supreme Court. And a march that was supposed to go from DuPont Circle to the Supreme Court, which had been given a permit to do so, was actually broken up by the police. So they reneged on their agreement. Which is an interesting thing to observe in light now of what's going on here in New York City for protests that are scheduled to be held during the Republican National Convention, when the city authorities are really complaining about United for Peace and Justice deciding not to go along with the previous agreement controlling their protests. What people who want to practice dissent in this country right now are finding out is that they're up against tactics and authorities that don't live by their agreements. And so I thought this was an interesting tactic taken by United for Peace and Justice to prevent something that was going to be done to them.
And, you know, a lot of people think this is the post 9/11 environment, but from, you know, from your book, it seems that control of protests predates 9/11.
Absolutely. Anybody who's seen Michael Moore's film, Fahrenheit 9/11, one of the most remarkable segments of that film, and the one that I keep hearing people say was a surprise to them, was the footage of the inaugural protest. That's the only place I've ever seen it, having been there that day. I, of course, didn't see whatever coverage there was.
Yeah, there's an egg that hit the presidential limo, right?
There was a...
We never heard about that before.
We never heard about that egg. That was actually about the only thing that was reported on, was one egg hitting the limo, and kind of they didn't detail the other things that hit that limo, such as rage from tens of thousands of people. But... I think anybody who has seen that film, you can say what you want to about the film, but there's some straightforward footage that shows you what it was like, and it was utterly incredible. It was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen, and I can't really overstate the visuals there, the military presence. There were lines of police in front of us. The police were lined five deep, and they were backed by the Marines. And standing at the intersection were troops of mounted cops, state troopers with their big hats on, riot cops, kind of all dressed up like modern day ninjas, were paraded in front of us on regular occasions. It really looked like a city under occupation, because it was.
I was speaking with Dennis Lloyd-Johnson, author of the book The Big Chill, The Great Unreported Story of the Bush Inauguration Protest, recently published by Melville House Publishing. And you get home and look at the papers on January 21st, and you don't see much, right?
Well, I not only didn't see much, at least in the paper that I've subscribed to, the New York Times, but what I saw was actually the opposite of what happened. And what I'm referring to here is one thing that protesters that went to Washington felt they had accomplished was that they had created such a hostile environment along the parade route that the president was unable to get out of his car and do the traditional walk along Pennsylvania Avenue that has become a tradition at least since Jimmy Carter did it in the 70s. He was the first that couldn't. And that felt
Carter made this as part of a great Democratic gesture. He was a man of the people who was going to walk part of the way.
Absolutely. He didn't walk part of the way. He walked all the way from the Capitol steps to the White House, shaking hands, waving, et cetera, with his wife and at least one of the kids, and with Amy. And every president since has done at least part of the route. It's a great tradition. It's an important tradition. It's a telling tradition. And Bush couldn't do it. And what happened when I came back and opened the New York Times the next morning was that there was a giant photo of Bush standing next to his limo with his wife waving to the crowd. And the Times caption said something like, President Bush walks the parade route, which he hadn't done. So it was a staged photo. What had actually happened was that the presidential limousine, which had raced by the crowd, as is depicted in the Moore film, you can see the actual footage. It came by at really high speed. I felt very bad for the Secret Service agents who were running full tilt boogie next to the limo, trying to keep up with it and unable to do so. It raced by and it went into this kind of occupied zone they have around the White House, which is a steel barriers and stone barriers and cyclone fencing and barbed wire and lots and lots and lots of police and military.
Also, all pre-9/11.
All pre-9/11. And the only people in there, of course, were donors and family and things like that. And then he got out of the car because the trip was over and he was home. That's the photo that ran in the newspaper. Several papers noted that he was unable to walk the route, but the New York Times didn't, and most of the papers that followed follow it didn't either. And then there were other things going on. As I note in the book, ABC News, for example, the famous presidential historian Michael Beschloss, who was acting as a commentator that day, was actually saying things. I quote him in my book. Fair did a great job of documenting what happened on television that day. Saying things such as, wouldn't it be terrible if the president wasn't able to get out of his car because he was afraid of the people here in Washington along the parade route? Wouldn't that be awful if he wasn't able to keep up that great tradition? What Beschloss never said was, in fact, he did not keep up that great tradition.
R.W. Johnny Apple, writing in the Times.
The great.
The Bigfoot Apple, did have a phrase or two about the protest, but the rest of the paper, there was nothing?
There was one article buried in the paper, I think on A18 or something like that, a very small article. I think it was 600 words about security concerns. And it did mention that there were 100 anti-abortion protesters in Washington that day. And it talked to one anti-Bush protester that day. And it contained the only photo that the Times ran of the protest. And it was so small you couldn't really make out what those weird, looked like oranges or something, surrounding a few hippie-looking people. And, of course, what it was depicting, if they had blown it up, you would see, was riot cops surrounding some protesters.
And either you or your wife wrote to Apple and got a response?
My wife, everybody I know who was there that day went home convinced that this was a huge story, that the press was going to have to write about the fact that a big chunk of America thought something was out of whack with democracy. And, of course, we were stunned to get back and see not only no coverage of it, but actual disinformation in the paper of record, so-called. So she fired off letters. The New York Times that day had four articles all about the inauguration on the front page. It took up the entire page. She wrote to all the reporters that had a byline on the front page that day, and Apple's the only one who wrote back, and he said he agreed with her. She should be enraged. He was shocked. He was. It was not his job to cover the events. He was writing analysis, as the only person who had at least mentioned the events, he was forwarding this email and others he'd gotten like it onto what he called the powers that be. And that, of course, is the last she heard from any of them.
Apple taking a break from his tough beat of covering restaurant openings in Sydney, Australia.
He's got a nice gig.
He certainly does have a nice gig, you know, this week in Sydney, next week in Bangkok.
Well, he has been filing reports, I noticed, from the Democratic Convention. He filed some reports. So he's back, and I think the Times is better for it, but it is not a regular beat for him anymore.
So you've got this bit of recovered history called The Big Chill. I've been speaking with Dennis Lloyd-Johnson, author of that book, The Great Unreported Story of the Bush Inauguration Protest. Also, two other books in this series. Do you have a name for this series, or is it just?
We don't. We couldn't think of one, so They just kind of look obviously like a series.
Yeah, they do. They look like siblings, attractively designed. Just a few words about other people's books while you're here. Mark Danner, The Road to Illegitimacy. What's that all about?
Well, Mark, of course, has gotten a lot of attention lately because he's been filing some really devastating stories about the prison torture situation in Iraq for the New York Review of Books. Just a really amazing series of articles he's done for them on that. But he's a longtime staffer at the New Yorker magazine and has written for all kinds of places like Harper's, et cetera. This is his story about going down to observe the final vote recount in Florida. I have a suspicion that a lot of people still don't really know what happened in Florida. The average American just knows that some kind of mess happened down there and the Supreme Court ended it. Mark went down to see what really happened. After the Supreme Court decision, a consortium of newspapers and the Miami Herald first by itself demanded through the Freedom of Information Act that they see the actual votes, the actual pieces of paper that people had voted on, et cetera. And so an actual recount was finally held. And Mark reports on that. He went down and observed.
And, of course, the big question, can it happen again?
Well, it looks like it is happening again, doesn't it? Because we won't have a paper trail to watch this time. I don't have to tell your listeners in particular about the dangers of the computer tabulation systems that are being enacted right now, particularly in Florida. They've already had a couple of problems down there with some votes that they've used them on, such as Janet Reno's vote in 2002. I think it could happen again. And I think the other book in the series that you've been kind enough to bring up, Renata Adler's book, Irreparable Harm, about the Supreme Court decision, also, surprisingly, that could happen again.
And I should say, she's a Republican, isn't she?
Renata is a Republican, but she's what we used to consider a normal Republican. She's a normal person. Renata, of course, is very famous from her decades at The New Yorker. One of the first female reporters to go to Vietnam. She reported from Selma, a truly great, great journalist. And what a lot of people may not know is that she was also involved in the Watergate hearings, where she was an advisor for Peter Rodino. I think she wrote his speeches or something. And she's a registered Republican. But she's a great reporter, a great American, and she's in an absolute rage. She's also an attorney, and she's in a rage over the Supreme Court decision. Her analysis of it is fascinating, absolutely fascinating, and very frightening as well.
Well, what's she in a rage over?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, for one, she feels, of course, that the Supreme Court had overstepped its bounds and that it was a pretty blatant grab for power. Interestingly, let's say that the things had worked out differently, that Gore had done better in a recount in Florida. Renata points out that what this means is that two sets of delegates would have been sent to Congress, and seeing as how the Republicans were in a majority, that Gore would have lost anyway. So what the Supreme Court did becomes that much more blatant of a grab for power. They didn't need to do it. Which is a really interesting analysis, and one I've heard nowhere else, and that's why we wanted to publish this book.
And, of course, I believe Scalia said in his decision, or his opinion, rather, that the people have no right to vote for the president, and that constitutionally is true, that it's the Electoral College that elects the president, not the popular vote of the American citizens.
Exactly, but that's part of what Renata's analyzing, which is that they didn't need to do what they did. So why did they do it?
Well, the hunting partner of Dick Cheney might have had an interest in that, might have had a horse in that race. All right, well, thanks for joining us, Dennis Lloyd-Johnson. I've been speaking with Dennis Lloyd-Johnson, who is the author of the book The Big Chill, The Great Unreported Story of the Bush Inauguration Protest, part of a series of three books just published by Melville House Press. Also, Renata Adler's Irreparable Harm, The U.S. Supreme Court and the Decision That Made George W. Bush President, which is illustrated with 9 frightening photos of our Supreme Court justices, and The Road to Illegitimacy, the story of the Florida recount in 2000 by Mark Danner. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on until the evening. Till next week. Goodbye. Let's go out with a little more Stockhausen.